Hey everyone, how's it going? Welcome to the Know Your Gear podcast, episode 326. I hope everybody had a great week. I had a great week. The first one that I have from today's early riser is Aztec, who says, "Hey, I want to refret my Made in USA Paul Reed Smith Custom 24. I like the size and feel of the fret wire. What is the fret wire size I should buy from Stu Mac?" So if I was going to recommend a fret wire to refret your Paul Reed Smith guitar, I would go with the Jesscar fret wire. I'm not sure if Stu Mac sells that. I'm pretty sure I buy a lot of fret wire from Stu Mac, but I also buy it from other sources depending on what I'm after. But the fret wire, Jesscar fret wire, which is like what we use on the Badlands guitars, and a lot of other guitars, by the way, are using it as well, because it's very, very good, very hard material. And I personally like it. The fret wire that they're using, I know it's like medium jumbo. So let me see if it's like 47104. I should probably Google it now. So it's 47104 would be the fret wire. That's going to be like, it's going to be like Dunlop 6100 or 6150. That's what I would say. I would say it's like, that's going to be pretty darn close to what you're doing. I can tell you this, when I refretted my Paul Reed Smith Mira, I used Jesscar. I used that same size fret wire, the 47104, but I used it in stainless steel, so it has a different number because of stainless steel. But and I would recommend the stainless steel personally, but unless you have a hang up on the sound, you know, stainless steel is just controversial because it's like this great material that, to be honest with you, if they had it back in the day, they probably would have used it. Maybe not, because sometimes they were really cheap. Companies were really cheap and trying to save some money, but stainless steel fret wire is a great fret wire for someone who's looking for a kind of like never have to deal with a problem again kind of situation. You put it on the guitar, and it's not likely it's going to ever need a refret in its lifetime, with you at least, right? And the issue, though, sometimes with stainless steel fret wire is a lot of players say that it sounds different. It doesn't sound the same. As someone who has it on both guitars, what do I know? But I can just tell you what my experience has been with it. When I yank nickel fret wire off a guitar and put stainless on there, I can't tell the difference. However, generally speaking, a lot of times what I've learned is that guitars that have stainless steel fret wire tend to be different. What I mean by that is like a Kiesel guitar will have a stainless steel fret wire. And so you'll try a Kiesel Delos against your American Strat and you go, "Hey, it sounds different." And it's this stainless steel fret wire. And I don't disagree that stainless steel fret wire or stainless steel fret wire will sound different, as I've said in the past, than nickel. However, I believe the differences are so minor that there's so many other things happening with an instrument that I would attribute to being the tone difference. That's just it. Like for me, I would rather, like I said before, I would rather have bright fret wires, bright sounding fret wire that lasts forever than bright sounding strings. If I had to go pure nickel strings on stainless steel fret wire, I don't think that would work. It's the same kind of translation, but that's what I would rather do. I just like not having to deal with it. However, as I've said before, I have no personal, like, I don't not buy a guitar because it doesn't come in stainless steel fret wire. There's no, like, I don't buy Gibsons because of that or anything like that. It's what the guitar has is what it has. What I can tell you is that I'm way more abusive to my guitars that have stainless steel fret wire. In other words, I don't worry about them at all. It is kind of nice. Like, to me, if you give me a Relic guitar with stainless steel fret wire, that's a guitar I just don't even worry about. I'll lean it up against the couch. I'll drag it out, drag it, throw it in the backseat of my truck. I'll do anything with it because it's just a guitar that can, it's perfect. So there you go. Bobby Steele just came in with a question, and I like it because it's always a good one. It says, "Does changing the pickups lower the value of a guitar?" That's a great question because I think that sometimes that freaks people out, you know, when you change out parts on a guitar. The reality, Bobby, is it doesn't, especially if you keep the original parts and put them away so that if you can always return it back to standard. It is very, rare. Okay. Very. You're talking about something extremely expensive and vintage. So, like, for instance, if you said, hey, Phil, if I take my 59 Les Paul original, I take the pickups out, am I going to devalue it? Yeah, but I mean, even in that case, I could argue that if you put the original pickups back and when you ever went to sell it, you'd be fine. So don't worry about changing out the pickups. The things that changing of pickups can do to devalue a guitar is damage the guitar. You could damage the guitar while doing it, so don't do that. And also, somebody may not want the aftermarket pickups, so that's why it's nice to have the originals. I'm that way a lot. If I look at a used, I'll give you a perfect example. There's a lot of guitars on Reverb, well, like used Gibsons, and it'll say Gibson Les Paul with a set of Seymour Duncan 59s in it. And although I like those pickups, I don't want a Gibson with Seymour Duncans in it. I want a Gibson with Gibson pickups in it. So I will skip that. I won't go because I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to buy the Gibson pickups and they're going to be pretty expensive. But if it says put Seymour Duncan pickups, have original Gibson pickups, I'm like, that's bonus. Actually, I'm actually okay. Not only am I okay with it, I'm actually looking for that because for me, the time it takes me to swap the original pickups back in and have an extra set of Seymour Duncans for essentially the free, just my time in, I'm all about that. So there you go. Okay, and then Amanda grabbed a question for you from Gray, who says, evening from the UK, and he says, how close to P90s are humbucker-sized P90s like the Fat Cat? I've done some videos where I've compared that, and they're not exact. They're just really close. We're keeping the P90, not a noiseless P90 versus P90 kind of vibe. So not like a Fat Cat noiseless or anything like that. Just going with just the Fat Cat. They're pretty close, right? There's a lot of things, like I've said before, I don't think a mini humbucker, like a single coil size humbucker, can sound exactly like a humbucker. I did a video on that. That was just my take on the experiment I did, which is, you know, just playing with the interchanging pickups and stuff. It was just, I couldn't find a situation where I thought a mini single coil size humbucker sounded exactly like a humbucker to me. It just wasn't getting close. But with a humbucker size P90 versus a P90, especially in the same space, you know, the place on the guitar, I mean, it's different, but I don't know how much different it's going to be. You got to understand, like I said, it depends on the P90 too. We also have to talk about the anatomy of the P90. So we're also saying, are things equal? So in other words, is the P90 like an Alnico 5 versus the P90 humbuckers Alnico 5? For instance, you know, some P90s have ceramic magnets. I mean, there's all kinds of different anatomy and pickups. But if it was, I can tell you this, my Charvel DK24 does have a humbucker size P90 in the neck. I absolutely love it. It definitely has a P90 punch and vibe. I dig it. And there's nothing in my, nothing in me that's yearning to put a real P90 in that spot. As someone who loves P90s and I have a bunch of guitars with P90s, I love that pickup in that guitar. However, I'm not a huge fan of the noiseless humbucker P90s. Again, don't hate them. So, you know, almost all noiseless pickups, I'm just not a fan of them. And that's partially because I have the luxury of not worrying about them. What I mean by that is if I was at a gig and I had a lot of noise, I guess I would do it. But, you know, for a situation at home, making a YouTube video, I can use a noise gate or I can take care of the problem here. Hold on a second. Let's see. Let's see. This is another one that Amanda grabbed real quick. And this one was, he wants to know, can I use gauge fillers as nut files? I've seen that trick before. What you do is you're using filler gauges and you can wrap some, like I've shown the trick with using a guitar string. It's the same technique. You use a piece of sandpaper on it and use it as a nut file. Sure, you could do that. It's one of those things, like I said, I've done a ton of videos where I've used the bare minimum things I can use with tools. And the one thing I will tell you is this. The real factor in this is what can you do, not what can the tool do. I sometimes I get a little nervous because some people will ask me questions like, hey, Phil, can I, they're talking about me, do this thing, and I'll do it. And then I also have to understand that, like, there's 20-something years of doing this behind me. So, you know, I can kind of make it work. So, yeah, you can definitely make anything work. But it, the real contributing factor is going to be you. Can you do it? It's going to be, can you do it? Can I take some filler gauges, wrap some sandpaper on them, and make a makeshift nut file? Yeah, I did it with guitar strings. So, yeah. And now that you've seen me do it, you know it can be done. So give it a shot. But there you go. L Dudorino says tip cleaners work pretty good. L Dudorino, I would love for you to send me, especially since you're a channel member, if you could send me a link to the tip cleaners you use. I bought the ones on Amazon, and I'm just gonna, again, you know, honesty to a fault. I watched a YouTuber, actually two, but mostly one, say that they use them, and I was like, I have to admit, I probably feel like a lot of you guys, where I was like, oh wow. You know, I mean, I could buy those on dirt cheap. So I bought two different kinds off Amazon. They were absolute garbage, did not work. And actually, they were making everything worse. And then I found out that they weren't even like files, that they're just, like they said, they're tip cleaners for like, for a welder or something like that. And, you know, cause there was repackaged ones on Amazon that say that they're essentially, that's what they are. So I was really curious, like, how did the YouTuber do it? And then I went back to the video, and here's the thing that upset me. They never really showed you them doing it. They just said they did it, or they said they used them, and they kind of held it over the nut. And then that was the end of that conversation of that. So I don't know if they even tried it. So that's where I'm asking, if you could, El Dudorino, if you could send me the link to the ones you're using. I'm hoping maybe they're better, because trust me, if there was one thing I could share with the guitar community, would be that I would love to do when it comes to tools, is find a way to help more musicians get their hands on a file, a tool that helps you take care of your nut on your guitar that doesn't cost over $100 and something. I mean, nut files are super expensive no matter where you go with them and which ones you get. They are super crazy expensive. So there you go. But like I said, if you send that to me, great. And even if they're what I had used before, maybe, like I said, I can always be fault, but I did try them a couple times, and oh, they were horrible. In fact, I'm pretty sure in a video, I used them in a video in a deep dive section. I know, because I do so many videos, after a while they start blending. I'm pretty sure I used them in a video and showed that I couldn't get them to work, and then I showed something else. So again, could have been the ones I got my hands on. This one came through the Know Your Gear website, the Know Your Gear podcast website. It says, hey, Phil, how much did we raise for Ralph? What he's talking about was the – by the way, I just got mine and Ralph's shirts the other day, just like a lot of you guys. And so if you guys remember, Ralph said a funny thing. He said he got drunk once and found out how fast sweet water could ship. And I said, that's got to go on a shirt. And we sold you guys some shirts, and I said I would split the money with Ralph. So we made $120 isk dollars each. So it was like $250 is what we made. And then I tried to give Ralph $125, so half, and he was being difficult, as sometimes he is. So what I did is I told you guys that he loves this bourbon that's made in Arizona called Copper City Bourbon. And he really likes it. In fact, that's the bourbon he was drinking when he bought the telly. So he said, buy me a bottle of Copper City Bourbon. So what I did was I was thinking about it going, you know, you guys were so kind to buy the shirts, and I had this money, and I thought, okay, what do I do? So I thought, well, I don't want to just go to the BevMo and buy him a bottle of bourbon, you know. So what I did was I thought, oh yeah, it's made here in Arizona. So I Googled where it's made. I found out it's a distillery in downtown Tempe. I drove down there, and I found out that not only can I buy him a bottle of it, I did. I bought him a bottle of their whiskey rye, and I bought him a bottle of, they had a special bottle that's in like a wine cask, right? So it's a bourbon that's also in a wine cask. I don't know much about any of that. I just know it was on the bottle. It was more expensive that way, and it was amazing. I have to say, as I told you guys, I'm not a real huge connoisseur of that stuff, but boy, ooh, it's great. So I gave him those bottles, and he seemed super excited. I think he liked them. So let you know what happened. We basically put him on the on the road to buying another expensive guitar from Sweetwater. So let's see what happens. I'll let you know if one of those bottles work and he ends up buying another guitar. But yeah, that's what we made. And that gives you an idea. How many shirts, you know what I wish I knew is how many. Oh, I probably do. I could tell you how many shirts. Like I said, I like sharing all kinds of stuff with you guys. Let me see. Huh. Give me a second. Because I would really like to know how many shirts we sold, and I don't know if I have a link to it. I usually have it. Hold on a second. Again, if I can't do this quickly, I'll jump to the next spot, but I think I can find it. Okay. Ah, there it is. All right. All right. And then you guys will know how much money do you make on doing this stuff, right? Okay, so we go here, we go into the dashboard on the account. I'm looking right now. It's thinking as it does. And I'm going to go with campaigns. The Ralph Telly campaign. We sold 33 of the I Got Drunk Once and Found Out How Fast Sweetwater Could Ship shirts. Of course, two of those were to Ralph and I, myself. So you guys bought 31 of those shirts with a grand total. Oh, so it was a grand total of $329. So we made $330-ish off of 33 shirts. Keep in mind, though, we spent $64 on our two shirts, which takes you, you know, minus that, takes you down to like $270. And then when they deposit it into your account, they, you know, PayPal, whatever, took a piece. So that's how I ended up around the $250 mark-ish. So there you go. That's how it broke down. So for those that are curious, how much money can you make if you do a shirt campaign? And that was a really good shirt campaign. I was really impressed by that. So there you go. All right. Sorry. I like some of the bourbon jokes. So Paul says, I thought bourbon had to come from Kentucky. I don't know, man. I don't even know. All I know about if you're in the Phoenix, Arizona, you know, area, Copper City bourbon is something that I like it. I think they do a really good, it has an interesting flavor. It's like a lighter flavor. And what's interesting is it says that it's the first distillery in Arizona after Prohibition. I'm just telling you what the sign said on the bar. So there you go. That's the thing. That's, you know, look, Arizona doesn't have much going for it. Okay. We got to have whatever we can. So if there's our bourbon, we're just going to say, well, that's what it is. Okay. So, let's go to the next question. What's the next question or subject? Brent wants to know, do tuners ever need any sort of maintenance, like applying oil? Does it matter if they are open, back or Clusen style, Grover style? So if they're closed, back tuners, tuning keys, they don't require any maintenance whatsoever. Open gear tuners can need some kind of lubrication, especially if they get dirt or grime or anything in there, you know, right? So you might have to clean them out, disassemble, clean them. I haven't seen too much of that. One of the concerns you might have is corrosion from the elements, because again, they're open gear. So, and usually the gear sometimes is brass or some kind of material like that. So that could be a problem. A lot of the Clusen style keys are closed, but they'll have a little hole where you can put in some lubricant in there and take care of that. And yeah, so the answer to your question is, do they need maintenance? Some do sometimes, some never do. So you just have to know which kind, and I just kind of let you know how you're going to look for it. It's very easy to, and you can Google it, whatever style you have. All I can tell you that makes things really easy for you is this. If you have 100% sealed tuning key, in other words, you can't see any access into it at all, it does not require any maintenance. That's the upside of those. The downside of a totally sealed tuning key is they tend to be a little heavier. And that's why, because so if some of you are like, well, why do you use open gear? Well, first, that's originally what they had. And they went to a sealed tuning key. Obviously, for that reason, it's zero maintenance. However, encapsulating the gear in in the case adds weight. And some people don't like how heavy that gets. So, yeah, Dougal Dog says dust and grease. Yeah, there's all kinds. Yeah. So. Okay. Let's, next one. This is a good one. They want to know, does a bone nut make a difference compared to a synthetic bone when it comes to resonance? This is where I was talking about before, where I like these questions and conversations, because I think having a rational talk about them is sometimes needed. I think the difference in tone is so subtle that that's the not something you should overly worry about. I use Bo Nut. I praise Bo Nut a lot using a Bo Nut on a guitar because I like working with it, right? And I've said that before. It's a preference to how I like to work. Some of the synthetic materials they're not as easy to work with. I find bone is just, I just like the way it works. Just like graphite, it does the same thing. I like being able to run my file across something and it just immediately turn it right to powder, right? Instead of, you know, and because I've learned over time, I forgot what Luthier taught me the trick, but I learned this technique where whether I'm sanding on wood or whether I'm filing on metal, or if I'm filing on a piece of bone or graphite, to pay attention to the material that's coming off, because essentially, like, think about it like that, right? If you see a lot, if you're filing on a nut, you look down and there's a big pile of bone material there, then, you know, that tells you a lot, especially, if you've gone too far. So I like to kind of look at something and see it. Sometimes when I'm filing on synthetic, also sometimes synthetic, it's a little tricky because some companies claim to be synthetic bone. In other words, a harder type of material, like a plastic base, but it's harder. And then I find that I'm working with it. It's just not. So, but so, you know, for the record, I like new bone. It's new bone being in you bone. I like, the man-made materials as much. It's, you know, not a big deal. So there you go. A lot of the bone nuts I use are cow bone, and I like working with it. I've always kind of liked working with it. So there you go. Okay. And if you're doing a super chat, like I said, I'll grab them. Don't worry. They're kind of like pinned up for me to see on another screen. I'm just trying to hit what's going on right now. We have, someone says, I just got a Kiesel based on Philips Copper Penny Metallic. Do I have that guitar? No, it's in the other room. I'm playing it in the other room right now. Strat, I'm working on an actual project with Kiesel right now about that guitar. So it says Copper Penny Metallic Strat. It looks unreal. Man, I love that color so much. I wish I had more to do with it. I kind of told them what I was looking for, and then they came up with the paints. Swatch kind of thing. And they said, this is the color. And, I loved it. He says, honestly, it was the video on this channel that made it happen. I'm so happy. Yeah. I've said it before a million times, said it a million more. I love my Copper Penny Metallic, Delos. I mean, I love it. It's not, I like it, or it's really cool, or it's really a fun guitar. It's like, I love that guitar. It's becoming one of those, like, it just feels right. And it's always like, it's like there, it's my tried and true guitar. So I really enjoy it. And I love the way it looks. I love it. Especially since, as you've seen, very, very few people have that exact color. Okay.
We'll be right back. Ever wonder how your favorite entertainers and athletes made it from childhood to the spotlight? Join me, Nashville-based entertainment reporter Jennifer Vickery Smith, as I chat with moms of entertainers and entertaining moms on my hit podcast, Got It From My Mama. You'll hear delightful conversations with moms of everyone from the Jonas Brothers, Luke Bryan, Kelsey Ballerini, Steph Curry, Travis Kelce, and so many more, sharing the journey from a perspective only a mama can share. New episodes weekly as we share the best conversations of family, faith, and fame on the Got It From My Mama podcast.
Okay, so this question came also through the website, so we grabbed it. And it was an interesting question. And so, you know, I told you I did a bonus podcast audio this week with Mrs. McKnight. And there were some questions like this in there, but not this particular one. And for those of you guys that heard the episode, know about the trucker rodeo. I don't know why I'm bringing that up. But this is a great question, or at least it was an interesting question because it's behind the scenes kind of thing. It says, what was the hardest part of opening a music store? And, you know, questions like that, I think are... and maybe enlightening. I don't know, right? I think a lot of people would be really shocked what it's like to open certain types of businesses. You know, I, at this point in my travels, you know, I started a company making import bases. I built bases. I opened a music store. So first, let me just start with a couple things. When I opened the music store, when we opened the music store, we wanted to do repair. That was like a thing. I wanted to do repair, and we wanted to be like a community service music store, right? So you do the repair, you also have some items and stuff. And there was a lot of things, you know, to do in a music store. But when people ask me like this question, what was the hardest part of opening a music store? The hardest part, and this is why I like questions like this, because I think it's going to help a lot of you for a lot of things besides music stores, was negotiating leases. There's a skill set involved. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do a music store type business, you know, this kind of style business. One of the, I think the smarter ways, which was not an option that was available to us, is to find a building that you can purchase and put your business in it and let your business pay that mortgage. That's a great system if you can do it. A lot of music stores do that, but they end up in a lot of places where it's not as high traffic and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of things to deal with because, you know, older neighborhoods, right? Because where the buildings are more affordable to people, you know, music retail isn't a high profit business. And because of that, you're not going to be able to pay a high mortgage on that. In our situation, what happened is that at the time of opening music stores, we were in a boom. So you got to think like 2004, 2005. This is before the huge recession. This was the boom. That sounds great. It actually was horrible. And the reason why is that we were in a property boom. So you have, you know, the not only were houses going sky high at that time, rent was going sky high, especially commercial rent was going sky high. And what happened was it was almost impossible to find anyone to rent to us. So to give you a reference, because I know a lot of you don't live where I live, but a lot of you guys are fans from that used to hang out in our store for years, right? One thing I want to tell you is my store was on a street called Chandler Boulevard in Chandler, Arizona. All you have to know is that street has about 22,000 cars a day on it at that time. I don't know what the current number is. Probably a lot more. Probably almost, you know, not double, but a lot more. So again, it's a busy street. The importance of this is what I'm going to tell you is that I don't know how many miles, I wish I can remember how many miles long Chandler Boulevard is, but it is a very long road with a lot of businesses, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of businesses across that street, across it from point to point. It crosses into essentially three cities. It goes, you know, right? Why that's important is, when we were looking to open a store in the areas that we wanted to open in that time, we found two available storefronts that were available. That's it, two. So to give you a reference now, I bet you if I was to look now for a storefront in the same area, I'd probably find 30. I'm not exaggerating. Right now, I'm sure there's 30 open listings for that size store shop in the area right now. And that isn't anything, because I can tell you like probably a couple years ago, there was probably 60, okay? But at that time, there was two. And the first one I contacted, it's very tough when you're a new business because you have no clout. You're going to the broker and you're like, hey, I want to open a business and I need to rent a space for that business. And this is, I know this isn't very sexy. I know this is like boring because you wanted to know about a guitar store, but this is important to know. What happened at that time, the question was, you know, what was the thing that was most difficult? This was the thing. The very first place I talked to, they gave me a price. I believe it was $9,000 a month at the time, close to it. And then there was obviously CAM's maintenance expenses. It was a lot. I mean, obviously at that time, I was like, this is insane. I mean, I can't pay $10,000 a month and rent, you know, put yourself, you know, on the hook for that. That's insane. And I remember talking to the real estate broker, the agent, and saying, this is crazy. And they said, well, we just signed, what did they say? We just signed Payway for 5 years and they're going to lose money. They just want the spot that bad. And I thought, well, good. Oh, it was Panda Express. It was Panda Express was going to lose money. That's what he said for 5 years. And I was like, well, that's nuts. Let them lose money. I'm not doing that. So we were calling places, and no one would call us back. As soon as we said, you know, hey, we're a new business and we want to open a music store, and this is, you know. And I kept thinking, like, I would find shopping centers, and I was trying to hit them with, like, where we would fit. You know, they would have, like, other businesses that I thought would you know, benefit from us and vice versa. And especially because we knew we were going to have lessons, you know, that's people coming every week, every single week sitting. So if we have a grocery store in that shopping center, they'll go to the grocery store, you know, Starbucks, you name it. And I don't remember how many it was, but it was definitely after about 5 or 6 flat out no's. And that's not including all the ones that just told me, you know, wouldn't even respond. Somebody basically told us no. Not here's the price. You got to understand, the prices we'd be throwing out was just ridiculous. Okay, you couldn't pay them. But at least you'd get the price and go, okay, well, we'll go from there. We'll figure out where we can't afford. And I remember we got told no by a shopping center. And I didn't know what to do at that point, because what I had done is I bought a ton of inventory. And it was at my house, right? So I was building the store. We were building the store at the, you know, like, so in other words, we're not only building the actual store, trying to find a store to put the store into, I was getting the inventory, doing all the stuff. We were ramping up this dream, this idea. And how we got the store that we have, so we had 2 stores, right? We had the first one, and we grew to a larger store a couple years later. But the first store, how we got it was we called the shopping center. I talked to them, and they called me back and told me that they weren't interested in having us as a tenant. So it didn't matter. We had great credit. It didn't matter. We had the money for the lease. It didn't matter anything. And by the way, the lease was insane. It was an insane lease that I just couldn't even mentally understand why we were even thinking of doing this, because it was so crazy high. But even then, being told no, imagine if you could, that scenario. You're like, they want an insane amount of money. You're like, okay, I'll do it. And then they go, no, we don't even want you. You're just not even worth our time. And so I didn't know what to do. So I, at that time, I worked for a big corporation. And one of the things that I could do, as I've told you guys before, I used to do, I was Oracle certified. I did Oracle databases, and I also did Davox, which is it's a dialing system. It's a phone system. You know, I ran those systems for a large corporation as one of my jobs. And so what I did was I called, I had a buddy, his name was Jay. I have a buddy, his name's Jay Klein. And I called the shopping center after they told us no. And I said, and I'm doing off memory, so I'm trying to remember what I said, but it was something to the effect of, I got them on the phone and I said, hi, my name is Jay Klein and I'm with VH1. And I had set it up to where when I called them, I was calling them from a Hollywood, California area code, right? I said, hi, my name is Jay Klein and I'm with VH1 and we're doing a reality show of young entrepreneurs trying to do exciting and fun things like open skate shops and music stores and painting studios and the trials and tribulations that go with that. And a client, which was the McKnights, has basically been trying to get a space for rent, and obviously you turned them down. And we would like to talk to you if you would be willing to have us talk to you about why that is, so we can put that in the show. And they said, well, can we get back to you? And I said, sure. And they got off, they talked to me for a few minutes. They got off the phone. And then they called me on my cell phone directly, and I answered it. And the first thing out of their mouth was, hey, we would like to talk to you about signing the lease. And that's where we got that shop. That's how we got that. So that was crazy. Okay. And by the way, when we moved into that shop, there was the only available pad in that shopping center, and it was the only available pad in a mile in either direction. So that's what it took to get a pad at that time, whatever it took, right? I mean, obviously, we paid their rates. We did everything they asked. I came up with an idea. I was like, okay, I got to figure out how to get these people to understand to talk to us, because no one would talk to us. So we did it. We paid their insane rent. And then luckily for us, within 2 years, the landlord came to us and said, hey, I have a bigger pad, because if you're doing the math, right, 2 years later, what's happening 2 years later? Now we're in a recession, right? So now what was happening was, as the recession started, they came to us and said, look, you guys are doing great. At the time, we were doing great. And he said, the bigger pads are harder to sell right now. Would you move to a bigger pad so I could lease out your smaller pad and I'll give you a deal? And we took the deal and we moved. So that's how we ended up in the bigger space in that shopping center. And we were, there you go. So what was the hardest part of opening the store? Was getting the actual pad at that time. Obviously, things have changed. It's not as difficult now. Maybe it is. So I don't know. If, you know, what I will tell you is that if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a person like this, look, I'm not saying you should do whatever it takes, but you have to do more than nothing. Does that make sense? You have to try. And at that time, I was just in shock that we couldn't get a space. And then the other thing that I should also mention is I've become very, very good, not great, at negotiating leases and contracts since then. And it's one thing I've learned to perfect. And I would highly, highly recommend that, not only having a good attorney, but also learning how to talk and read and write a contract and figure out contracts and how that should be negotiated. Because I'll tell you, my second hardest thing I ever had to do with the store was that same landlord renegotiate a lease when the recession came full force, because we were still paying peak rates. And while we watched 3-4 stores in our shopping center go out of business during the recession, we were fortunate. And one of the things we were fortunate was I called him up and I said, look, I know you're losing everybody. In fact, I'll finish the story with this. I remember the first thing, it was a her. I remember the first thing she said to me. I said, look, you've lost a bunch of tenants, you know, because they went out of business. I said, look, it's really tough out there. You know, it's a recession. I'd like to renegotiate the lease to some kind of scenario that helps us both, you know. And she said, well, so you know, the shopping center is only down 10%. And I said, yeah. Well, 10% isn't a lot until you lose another 10%, and then another 10%, another 10%, and then next thing you know, 40% of your business is gone. So can we negotiate before we're at that situation? And to our credit, we were very lucky. They negotiated with us. They were like, yeah, let's figure out, you know, kind of like, let's go month to month. Let's renegotiate this, and then we'll look at the market, you know, monthly, quarterly. And then if the market picks up, you know, we'll hit you. And of course, it took a long time. The market did not pick up. And that also what saved our ass, because again, at that time, so you guys know, we were paying $7,700 a month plus CAMS, monthly maintenance. Just to give you guys a reference to that stuff. I know some people have. I have no idea what the current market is. I mean, if somebody told me they paid $20,000 for rent, I wouldn't be shocked. And if they told me they paid $2,000, I have no idea. I just can tell you at that time, in my type of size store, my type of area, town, and that stuff, that was about what stuff cost. So that meant every month, as soon as you made $8,000 profit, you were now at zero. You're like, okay, the landlord's paid, let's start making some money for us, which is a lot. It's a lot to pay. And I'd never really want to hopefully have to pay that kind again. We'll see. All right, let's go back to some, well, that's guitar still, but let's go back to more question. Guitar questions. Let me grab some of these, just a couple of these super chats, because they're always kind of easy for me to detect and see. Al says, hey, modding my Paul Reed Smith SE245 to PAFs for blues classic rock. Do you recommend upgrading the pots to CTS and orange drop capacitors? Are all CTS 500K pots created equal? I don't know if they're all created equal. I'm not a huge like, oh, potentiometers make or break the sound. I think you definitely need a level of quality that's really important with them. There are brands that I like for certain potentiometers. Like, I like Born's potentiometers. I like their quality. Like I've said before, I like Switchcraft. And of course, stuff like that is tough because, you know, I used to buy this stuff in such huge bulk when I was doing full-time repairs and YouTube part-time, you know, kind of deal, right? And now that YouTube and all this other stuff seems to be taking up so much more time than all that other stuff, I don't buy the bulk I used to. So I'm not as informed in certain areas about that stuff. But I can tell you that it's getting tough out there to get quality parts, even I deal with that when we deal with, have to do with the Badlands stuff or whatever we're doing with parts or parts is a problem. I like orange drop capacitors. I like the quality of them. So I say, go for it. And I say, yeah, why not upgrade all that stuff? First of all, do it just because why not? Right. There's nothing inherently wrong, as you guys seen the deep dives I've done of SE's, you know, PRS, like I said, is one of the companies that likes to send guitars to the channel. So we get to see a lot of them over the years. And overall, their parts are fine. I like I said, my only issues with some of the three-way switches, and that's really becoming an issue across all the entire industry. I think we have a three-way switch, specifically three-way switch issue across the entire industry where we're finding defective parts. But I think upgrading your potentiometers, one thing I would tell you to think about when you look at potentiometers is the low friction, no friction, high friction kind of feel. That is a huge thing to me. You know, if you don't like them loosey goosey, or if you, you know, if you don't like it where you kind of have to wrench down on it a little bit to turn it, you need to think about that and then look at that as a potential thing more so than the sound or quality. Does that make sense? I mean, it's, that's just my thoughts on that. Gene says, hey, Phil, new guitar day, a mint used Fender American Vintage 250s Telecaster for a lot. Oh, for a lot off. I think it's off MSRP. Perfect and unfunked. Loving it. It says, like you've been talking about, used but actually new. Oh, I get where we're going with this. He's basically saying he just bought a brand new guitar that's not that was labeled as mint. I get it now because of what we talked about. Yes, absolutely. And he got a good deal. And that's really, really good deal. You know, I mean, it was really good that you got the deal. And like I said, there are really good deals out there. I'm for the first time that I could ever remember since I've been on Reverb, I am not only not trying to not follow any products, because I feel like everything I follow on Reverb, somebody sends me an offer right away, and those get a little too tempting for me. You know, the last thing I need is more stuff, but you know, sometimes when you're like, oh, I don't know, that's a good deal. In fact, a week ago, I bought a guitar pickup that was like $90, and even my wife, she was like, did you just buy a guitar pickup for $90? I'm like, yeah, it was a really good deal. Because they kept sending me offers. And I was like, ah, I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to stick it in. I don't know why. I got thousands of pickups laying around. But anyways, the thing on Reverb now that's really crazy now, if you guys haven't experienced this, is I'm getting offers to things I didn't even look at. They're things that are like things I looked at. So I'm looking at, like, I'll click and follow maybe like you, maybe a vintage, you know, reissue Fender Telecaster. And I'll follow one, you know, seller, and then I'll unfollow, sorry, you know, are not on, you know, on, I'm not looking at it anymore. And then a couple days later, I get an offer and I go, oh, it must be for that one. I look and it's another one. Or like I said, I'm getting a lot of offers on products that I either didn't even follow, but maybe I looked at, or like I said, they're just like things I've looked at or followed in the past. So definitely can feel how aggressive the sales market on Reverb is getting. And that's why when I tell you guys, if you're out there buying gear, like obviously some of us are, we have a problem, you know, hey, but there's worse problems to have, you know, be aware, this is the time where you want to look to see if you can find, you know, if you're going to buy something, if you can put some money in your pocket, put that money in your pocket. It's just going to help you, right? It's your money. You work for it. You shouldn't have to give it away easily. Next question. It's from Bobby Steele. This one. Oh, who gave me this? Oh, the missus gave me this because she's a moderator too. It says, anniversary models, fake hype or limited edition? It's fake hype, but it's real hype. It's artificial hype. So perfect example. I feel pretty versed in that. I've always talked about limited editions and anniversary models and all that stuff. And obviously it's not. Not only have my opinions been very consistent over the years on this particular subject, I'm now involved in a guitar company that's exactly doing that, right? You know, believe it or not, there was a question, and this will tie in. I love it when I can answer two questions or subjects at the same time. So there was a question, and the question came to us. It said, I've mentioned now on the podcast that the market is a little soft and the market's slowing a little bit and the discounts are getting heavier. But in the same time, I helped release a line of Badlands guitars that sold out really fast at an even slightly raised price in the first run. What's up with that? And what's nice is I love this because two things can be true even if they are contradictory to each other at the same time. Like one is not absolute, right? There can be multiple things that are both true. It is true the market is soft. People are buying less guitars right now, less amps, less things. Again, that's all it's needs to be said. People are buying a little bit less than they were buying before. However, there are ways you can combat that as a business. And one of the ways that we have combat that is by exactly what you're asking me, anniversaries and limited runs. It's an artificial thing. So for instance, you say, hey, we're doing an anniversary model. We're only going to do 500, right? Now you've created a artificial reason for someone to make and pull that trigger, right? Because it's not going to be around in a year. It may not be around at all. You might want to get it before it's, you know, before it's too late. You better hurry up and get it. And this is something I've told you guys in the past. Fender, I think when I was a Fender dealer, I watched Fender master this technique with the Fender FSR, Fender Special Run Series. They would always run them during the summer. And as a dealer for Fender, it was a saving grace because summer was a little tough to get through, and it still is to this day in the retail industry. You know, there's families take that free extra money and they go on vacation. You know, kids are out of school and they go, okay, let's go to, you know, let's go and see grandma and grandpa, let's go to Disneyland, whatever. And that money, it's not going to the local businesses, and it's definitely not going for guitars. So you see a slowdown in the summertime. So what Fender would do is create a special run. Some guy would come in the store, and I go, instead of saying, hey, he's like, oh, I'd like to get a red American Strat, but I think I'm going to hold off. I go, oh, well, that one is not red. That's Burgundy Mist Fire. And it's only, and they only made 60 pieces. And if you don't get this one, it won't be here when you get back. And you can put that emphasis and get them to pull that trigger. And when I said it's artificial because somebody decided what that is, right? It's literally like they decided. They decided how many. Now, this is what's really interesting. And this ties into what we did at the Badlands with the limited run. One of the things I did not like, and with companies when they do limited runs, is it's always felt to me that a lot of companies will figure out exactly what the market wants and make more than that. And that's one of the things I hated about being a dealer. And I'm not picking on Fender because, I mean, every company was guilty of it to some degree. And sometimes it was an accident and sometimes it was purposeful. And what I mean by that is, you know, they know that there's probably 1,000 customers out there for this product and they make 2,000. And as a dealer, if you got, when you first got them in, they sold like water and you were super excited. But then that second batch was like impossible to get rid of. It was just, it was boat anchors because everybody who wanted a crazy fire mist something burgundy Strat, they got one and they're done. And I used to see this a lot with Guitar Center, a lot. A Guitar Center would get a special run of product and they would sell out fast the first run, but by the end of the year you'd see them on closeout because they had too many. They over ordered. Which is why, yes, to answer your question, anniversary models and limited edition, is it fake? It is fake in the idea that somebody made it up, right? It's not real, okay? So this is a reality of this. Now, Badlands, one of the get-out-of-jail-free cards that we have is we do have a physical limitation to how many we can make. I mean, we have a, right? We just can't make 1,000 if we wanted to. It's impossible. So that's, it's just, you know, it's too small of an organization. It's too small. You know, everything's too small. So when we set a limit, it's not just based on like, oh, this will make people jump on them. It's the max we can make, which just happens to be not enough. And so that's okay right now. Right. That's we leaned into that. We said, look, the irony of this is we know we can't make enough, but that's okay because that creates some excitement for us right now, right? So we're leaning into that logic, and I think it's smart. I think it's a smart move, and it's fair because, like I said, it's. I mean, you can't make more than you can make. But yeah, that's a great way to do it. And so it answers two questions. One, the fake anniversary limited edition thing. Yep, that's an artificial fear missing out thing that they could create. But It is real. Like I said, I really believe this. Like when, I mean, you look at old FSR runs and stuff, I mean, they do end up going up in value, which is cool. The second part of the question is, why did the Badlands sell out when I said it's a soft market? It's because those two things are true at the same time. It is a soft market. And all that means, and this is what I've been saying, is that it doesn't mean that nobody's buying guitars. I mean, obviously selling 100, basically $3,000 guitars in 48 hours, is not a huge thing, but it's not a small thing. And it basically shows that people are in the market for those kind of guitars. What it does show, though, is there is not as many, and they are going to scrutinize what they get. And you have to give them value. And if that value means a new decreased price, so, and if that's Fender dropping its price or somebody dropping its price to get that excitement. For instance, the earlier question we got was, he basically said, yeah, he just bought a brand new Fender vintage reissue Telecaster that was labeled mint when it was new to get a lower price. That was the value that was given to him. The value was that he was able to get a guitar that he wanted at a more obtainable price to him, or a price that he could validate. Badlands, what we did to add the value was we created the opportunity. The opportunity being, there's only so many, and this is what it is. And this is, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to do it now, or you're going to wait and see how it works out. And that's how you do it. But like I said, back to the reality, which is the important part, which is we could only make 100 even if we wanted to make more, we physically can't. We're at max capacity. So there you go. That's the answer to that question. Plus, it's a good value. We gave value. That helps. I'm sorry, guys. I'm just reading some stuff. Hold on. Kyle wants to know if I played an Iconic guitar. I have not. How do they compare? I don't know. To Exotic and Sur? I have not. I don't know. I'm interested. Like I said, I'm interested in all guitars. It's the one thing I hope, if there's one thing that people can, understand from me as a person, on my channel. I once heard a famous podcaster say that whether you like him or whether you hate him, he's done thousands of episodes. So if you watched it, you at least know who he is, because you can't talk this long. Like he said, you can't talk this much this long and people not figure out what your personality is, what you're doing. I feel that way about videos and the show and all this stuff. I've done so many videos. I've talked for so many hours, so many years, that whether you hate me or like me, that's up to you. But at least you know where I'm coming from. One thing about the channel I like is, yeah, I'm the guy that likes to take a $100 guitar and show you why I think that's great. And I'm the guy that likes to take a $4,000 guitar and show you why it's great. And if you don't take away that I just like guitars, the prices are irrelevant to me. Whether they're expensive or cheap, it's all something I find interesting. I find inexpensive guitars interesting. I find expensive guitars interesting. I find it all interesting. That's all. And if you do too, that's great. Okay. So this one came from Unfreaking Believable. He grabbed a question from Kyle and he says, hey Phil, do you think that guitar manufacturers overseas fall victim to the same brain drain that tech companies do, as in people leave to the USA once they get skilled for more money? Oh, interesting. No, I don't think that's a thing in our industry. I know what you're saying. So basically what you're saying in the tech, I think it's in the tech sector, right? Your tech companies, where they're overseas and they come here. I don't see that. I hope I understand the question correctly. I don't see it that way. I don't see a lot of companies come into the US. I do see, cause here's why. What's funny is you would think, what I see a lot of in our industry is a token. It's like a token attempt. What I mean by that is you'll see companies in the US that make USA made guitars. They're obviously expensive. And then they make imported guitars that are less expensive. Okay, that makes sense. They're doing that angle. Then you see companies overseas that only do, I'm assuming that's what we're talking about here, imported guitars. And their guitars gain value and are not value. They gain momentum. People are interested in these guitars. And what I see is that they come and have and they start doing runs of guitars in the U.S., but it's always like a token run. It's just to show that they did it. Like, oh, look, we make high-end guitars too here in the U.S., expensive guitars. But it never seems like a full-hearted attempt. It's very important that I also tell you, because like I said, I always tell you guys that everybody's biased. It's just what the bias is. My bias is very, very succinct when it comes to this issue. I believe that the majority of USA guitar companies are trying to just make us think they still give a crap about building guitars in the USA. And this is a divided opinion. Some people are like, hey, who cares? I buy my guitars overseas and they're great. And you're right. I publicly say Schecter guitars are some of my favorite guitars and they're made in Indonesia and Korea. And I think they're fantastic. And that's the end of the day on that for me. That's all you need to know. I think they're great. However, you know, I live in America and I want, you know, in the United States and I want products to be made here. And that's just something I care about as well too. And there's a desire in me to want guitars made all around the world for all kinds of price points and all kinds of reasons. Like I said, I don't hate any guitar. They're all exciting to me in some way. But what I find that I don't like is the marketing and the attitude of a lot of companies that try to kind of make you think they're really thinking like you when they're not. Here's what I mean by that. I love Gibsons, but Gibson really loves Epiphone. I think that's true. I don't mean that to be in a negative way, and I hate calling out Gibson because I mean, that's not fair because there's a ton of the companies I could call it, Fender, PRS, all of them that way. They're making guitars import. They're making guitars USA, of course, because they're hitting all the levels. But you know, I told you there's companies to me, like I see companies like Kiesel Guitars, and Kiesel Guitars is trying to make one type of guitar, a guitar in the United States at the lowest price point possible. There is no desire. Everybody has an opinion about Kiesel Guitars, and some of them are negative and some are positive, and there's a ton of reasons why, but I'm not, again, talking about the guitars. Can we just talk about the business for a second? Kiesel Guitars is not trying to make you a affordable import guitar and then an expensive USA guitar. They're trying to make you the most affordable USA-made guitar that can be made. That's in high production, okay? So if you have a friend named Dave who makes guitars in Minnesota and you want to tell me how he's trying to do it too, I'm sure he's doing it too. There's small shops that I love that are giving you great value, okay? Beltone Guitars, this Tele behind me, this guitar right here, it's not hard for me to tell you guys that as much as I like the PRS guitars, the new PRS Tele at essentially $3,000 to me is a value proposition when you can buy this made in USA guitar with a hard shell case and get it semi-custom for less than what PRS is offering. That's a great value. But we know why, we think we know why PRS is offering a basic Telecaster for $3,000 because they're probably going to make an import one for $1,200. See, they have an agenda, and again, this isn't to villainize these guys. It's just to explain the business model logic. PRS has a desire to put premium on their American series so that the import series is more obtainable to everybody. And they win either way, right? You either pony up and buy the big dog because it's in your head that you have to have it, and we're all guilty of that. I told you I'm just as dumb as anybody else when it comes to wanting something based on a Guitar World ad that I saw when I was 18. And so you understand that's the agenda. And so I like companies that's not their agenda. I mean, I prefer them. So, I mean, and there's very few of them anymore. There's very few companies. Look, Sir Guitars doesn't do imports. They tried some, it didn't work out for them. So they stayed with USA Guitars. They make fantastic guitars. Sir makes fantastic guitars in the USA, but they come at that cost. That's the crazy cost. And again, I'm not saying that a Kiesel is affordable. I'm just saying it's more obtainable, right? And it's why is it more obtainable? Because if Kiesel doesn't sell you a guitar tomorrow, they don't stay in business. If they don't sell you that semi-custom made in USA guitar, they don't stay in business. And I can tell you for sure, Fender, Gibson, and Paul Reed Smith can sustain with huge drops in their USA lines. They would sustain off their import lines because they're so much bigger and so much more profitable. So 250 says, Sir makes Badlands? Sir doesn't make Badlands. I can tell you right now, no one makes Badlands that is isn't an OEM. Our guitars are built by OEM, if you know what that means. This is I've said this before, I'll say it again. I'm sure one day you'll know who's building the Badlands guitars. Like, we'll talk about it. We've said this before, and I'll be very clear again. The main pushback is the manufacturer, the OEM, okay? So that builds the guitars for us under our specifications and designs, does not want... Our guitars are still too cheap. That's a big factor for us, right? They're expensive, don't get me wrong, but what I'm saying is that, you know, the company that builds our guitars builds other brands and wants to continue to build other brands, and they don't need this heavily advertised that we're working to make a more obtainable price guitar. So that's one of the factors in that. So, you know, just one. And the whole idea, so you know, is this, and then we're going on so many tangents today, but the whole idea of this is domestic outsourcing. So if you like the initial launch of Badlands when they said, hey, YouTubers, start a new brand, we got thrown into that pile. Like I said, I love that. It was good press for us and it did really well, and I'm happy. And like I said, I'm a small part owner in this. You know, there's a lot of owners in this brand that make it happen. And so if I can, whatever I do to make it successful, I'm proud of that. But what I will tell you is that anybody, you guys are watching this here, anybody watching this here, if you have the money, the time, the effort, the inclination to start your own guitar brand, the way most guitar brands are started now, you can do it. You can go overseas. That's what everybody does, right? They go overseas and they have a brand built. Look, June Parker, the owner of Quartet Guitars, he watches this show. He's a fan of the show. He's a great guy. I mean, we could reach out to June Parker and go, hey, let's make our guitars at Quartet. I'm sure he would. I mean, I don't know if he would do it, but I know he'd take my call. However, what I had talked about when we had talked as a group, as an ownership group, when we started this idea, we had this idea for these guitars, and the idea was domestically outsourced. In other words, why do we have to go overseas to have a guitar made? They can build guitars right here in the United States. We could just do it here. And there are shops in the United States that would love the work. Like I said, the shop that we're using hired two people. We're proud of that. I'm proud of that. Right? I'm proud that there's jobs that exist now that didn't exist before. That's a huge part. It's not even a big part of the goal, but it is a part of the goal. So we domestically outsourced it. So that's what we did. And that's why I love that idea. We're no different than a ton of companies that do it with boutique amp distribution, right? There's a ton of companies. Brian Wampler's pedals are made in the USA. They're domestically outsourced to boutique. Boutique's building them in California. He builds Friedman's amps, you know. It's an ingenious idea. You essentially, it's like using a commercial kitchen. You come up with a formula, right? Your grandma's old cookie recipe. You come up with all the marketing, you're going to do everything but the physical construction of the guitar. And that's important because that allows you to focus on R&D, developing new products, right? It's a lot different. If I had to clean out the trash can at the end of the day of building guitars, I wouldn't be able to work on how are we going to market the next one. So that's the idea behind this. That's what I said. I like talking about this. I don't know if you guys are interested in this stuff, so let me know either way. It's not about the brand per se as selling the brand. It's more about we're upfront about everything, the good and bads of doing this, because I don't know. Maybe you'll start a brand. Maybe you'll learn from this. I don't know. Maybe you'll do it better than us or worse than us, but then you'll learn from us. I don't know. But I love talking about this stuff. But it also gives me more insight in the industry that I had before, even though I think I understood some things. It really is nice to see how this all works and how things are done. And I feel like we got off track. So let's go back on track and go to the next section. The next question came from Jay, who says, happy Friday. I fell in love with a Princeton, but it's not loud enough to play with my drummer. What do you suggest to get the Princeton sound more available for volume? There's three things you can do with the Princeton immediately, and I'll do them in order of cost. You can put it on a chair. I know that sounds silly, right? But get it off the ground, right? Use it more like a monitor and less like an amp. And that means put it in a chair towards your guitar, your drummer more. that's, you know, that's a big part. There is a detriment to your drummer when your drummer cannot hear, okay, your guitar, because they don't play as hard. And maybe that's a big part of it. They don't play the way they normally would because they're trying to listen more. And, you know, that gets become more difficult. The second thing you do is upgrade the speaker. Obviously, if you upgrade to a speaker, it takes more. I don't know which Princeton you have, but either Princeton that I've ever dealt with, the speakers aren't awesome, especially for taking volume. So a better speaker will let you have a higher volume, get more out of that amp. The other thing you do is just run it into a different cabinet, whether it be a 112 or a 212. It's not that hard. You can run into a different cabinet and get more out of it as well. And that helps a lot. Those three things, that's within the confines of still keeping your Princeton. Those three things, all three of those things will definitely help get the volume up. So there you go. And then, of course, I guess I said three, but let's throw a fourth one. You could always get a monitor for the drummer and, you know, send a line out. I think the Princeton has a line out. If it doesn't have a line out, you can get some kind of attenuator or something. Not to attenuate it, but to run a line out to a monitor, a powered speaker. In today's day and age, you can pick up, go on Craigslist and probably try to find yourself a single PA cabinet or two PA cabinets that are powered that are dirt cheap. You can run a line from the amp to that. You're just trying to get it louder in the room. That would all help a lot. All four of those things would get you. Somebody says, get a guitar stand. It's cooler. You know, I just said chair because, you know, it's chairs, you might have a chair. I put my Princeton on a chair a lot. That's how I do it. It's the first thing, anytime I have a problem with volume of an amp not performing loud enough, the first thing I do is get it off the ground. I just want it as high as I can get it off the ground and directional as possible, because guitar amps are extremely directional. And, you know, yeah, you lose some bass response pulling it off the ground, but when you need that little bit more volume, you know, hey, tone sometimes has to suffer a little bit. Something's got to give. So there you go. What do we have? Adrian's question is, hey, happy Thursday. Adrian, you don't know what day it is, buddy. Maybe it's no, there's no way you could be in the past, right? People can be in the future, right? Like if you're in Japan, you're ahead, right? Europe's ahead of us, me, right? I don't know who's behind me. So I don't know. Maybe it's Thursday where you are. I'm trying to think. I have a global audience and I have to understand that, but I don't think. Oh, he says to you. See, it is Thursday. No, it's Friday to me. All right. Anyways, I just got a Schecter C1 Blackjack AEX baritone guitar. It's rad. I love that you just said it's rad. That's awesome. Best baritone ever played. Cheers. You know, you're never going to shock me with telling me how much you like a Schecter. I like Schecter guitars. I just like I said, my only critique is they kind of lean into the metal market pretty hard, and they kind of market in the metal market pretty hard. And I think they're more versatile than they kind of most people think. So there you go. Mr. S says, I want to protect the art on the back of my Adam Jones Epiphone limited edition guitar. Any clear plastic cover one can put on a standard shape like a Les Paul if it covers? I don't know. This is sadly out of my wheelhouse. This is not really like a guitar related question or even a finished collection. I don't know what you would do to protect it. One thing that might help is I know they make a clear plastic that's it's like static, right? In fact, let's, you know, since I'm just randomly saying stuff and I do have the internet right here, let's see if I can pull it up. There's like a static sheet, plastic sheet. Yes, I see it. I don't see, exactly what you need. But here's something for $16. I don't know. Let me look. I'll share. Hold on, I'll share with you guys. Let me go here. I don't see. So maybe this is it. You guys know exactly what I'm talking about, right? It's just a piece of plastic film. I don't know. Let me look. And I'll share. It doesn't use adhesive. It uses like static electricity and it sticks to it. And there's sheets like that. And you can put it on there. And You said Epiphone, so I'm going to assume they're using a polyurethane polyester finish. Doesn't matter which one it is, even if it's a UV cured finish. I'm not sure what, you know, every Epiphone's using and when. I just know they're not using nitrocellulose lacquer, which is the one finish that would react to anything that I suggest like that. Even if you use a static sheet, I would stay away from that. But in this case, that would be the way to go. I would not put anything with the adhesive on the guitar. Just FYI. There you go. There used to be something called a guitar sock. Is that still a thing? Which was like these, like things I would probably never suggest, but the original guitar sock. Let's see what it is. Oh, and it got an error page. but it was like essentially a some kind of cloth bag that you would put over this, your guitar, and cover the back. So, again, I have no idea. I'm just trying to be helpful, but I have no idea. Grumpy Mike Guitar says, thank the lovely Mrs. McKnight for doing that very special podcast. It was fantastic. I will definitely do that. Like I said, it was really a miracle that she did it. She usually doesn't do anything like that. That's not her thing. She's not into public speaking and all that stuff. It's just not her thing. She doesn't enjoy it. You know, and when you're doing stuff for free, I mean, she's not getting paid for it. So you're going to do it for free and you don't enjoy it. It's not a whole lot of desire to get you up there. But because she handles, Axe Sock. Thank you, David, by the way. Hold on. I promised to go back. Thank you, David. I was close. Guitar Sock, right? Let's see. Hold on. And Axe Sack. I think it's called Axe Sack. Nope. It's Axe Sock. Axe Sack? Axe Sock? Axe Sack. This is just getting weirder by the minute. Nope. Still didn't come up. So I don't know if they're still in business, but we're getting there. It's just nice. What's nice is, and this is again, just more so thank you guys. Because she handles the patrons and the team members, she fields all your service requests and all this stuff, and she helps me with a lot of stuff. She's gotten to know a lot of you, and when you guys said, hey, you know, it'd be fun if you answer some questions and, you know, about me, she actually came to me and said, I'll do it out of nowhere. I was like, oh, okay, let's do it. So, Tamp Blue says it was Phil talking in a high-pitched voice. Ah, I could do it. You know, it's funny, at some point in that episode, I did mimic her. I remember I did something where I think I mimicked her voice for a second. And when I was doing it, I'm like, oh, no, this shouldn't do that. You know, it's a husband thing. You know, right? Wives make fun of their husband's voice. I don't know why that is. And then husbands make fun of their wife's voice. It's a thing you do. Or maybe it's just us. So. But there you go. Okay, hold on. Let's go back to main questions again. Where is it? It is Dream Mago. Dream Ego 53. Dreamago says, "Hi Phil, my guitar has a string buzz at the first fret." No, at the first string. My guitar has a string buzz at the first string, 10th fret. Okay, there. Can this be fixed sanding down the 11th fret a little? This is something that's like that. We don't know if the buzz is being caused by the high fret. So you'd have to confirm that there's a high fret. Or if it's just the randomness of, you know, where the neck's set. So the proper procedure, of course, is to make sure the guitar is, tuned up. The action is set to where you want it. The neck is set, to the proper relief, whatever you want that to be. And then all those things being equal, if you use a fret rocker and you can determine that fret is high, most likely that's going to be the culprit. So this is where, like I said, it's tough on a podcast format when I'm not looking at it and you're asking me a question like that. I still have to talk in this terminology, like, I don't know, try these things and see if that works. But I can't say yes, definitely, because I'm not looking at the problem. Corey says, is it okay to leave a neck unfretted for a couple weeks before refretting? It is a 30-year-old maple neck with ebony. Yes. The The neck not having frets in it isn't a problem at all. Not that I've ever experienced. Usually your concern is that you don't have strings on a neck. That's a big concern when necks go without strings. I've had problems happen both ways, and I've had problems not happen both ways. I tend not to worry about stuff like that. It's like you're saying a couple weeks. To me, having a guitar sitting with no strings on it for a couple weeks doesn't usually ever concern me. Having frets or not, I wouldn't think there would be anything that would be causing an issue with that. Like, there's nothing where like, oh no, those little gaps, you know, they're going to close in. Yeah. The wood's not going to grow anymore. It's dead. So you don't have to worry about that getting closed in. And the neck warping or, you know, having forward bow because there's, you know, less integrity because you have slots cut in there and nothing filling them. That's just, again, very rare. I mean, I can't tell you everything. I can't say like, yeah, absolute. There's no absolutes in life, but I can tell you based on experiences, there's not a whole lot that I think you should be really, really worried about. Like, I wouldn't freak out. I would stick with it and you're fine. Enrico says, you feel like Gibsons, okay? You feel like Gibsons. The one to bad guitar ratio gets better as you go further into the custom shop. How about Fender Custom Shop? Who's got better CS Mojo? Custom Shop Mojo. I think that's the core of where your question's going, right? Who's better at custom shops, Fender or Gibson? I don't know the answer. I can tell you my experiences is that I've had both Gibson, because I've had nothing happen that is like what people say. You know, when people say, if you don't like Gibsons, get a custom shop. If you don't like Fenders, get the custom shop. I've owned production guitars from Fender and Gibson. I've owned custom shop guitars from Fender and Gibson. I've had bad experiences and good experiences. The ratios, unfortunately, are not the same because I can't buy custom shop at the same rate I would buy, production guitars. The working on the guitar is the same thing. What I've seen wrong with one, I've seen with others. I don't really know the answer. What I will tell you is that out of the custom shop Gibsons I've had and the custom shop Fenders, although I've had a bad custom shop Gibson where I was like really unhappy with the quality of it, I've seen more consistency and bad issues with Fender custom shops. So, and that doesn't mean, I'm not saying they were bad. I'm just saying there was more issues that were consistent. This is really the focus on guitars. And that's, to me, one thing that I try to focus on all the time, which is finding a issue with a guitar is not important. Finding one issue that's consistent across a bunch of guitars is important because that tells you there's a problem, you know, that they have to address. So I don't know. I will tell you, I feel like I've bought all the custom shop guitars at this point and I'm done. Got it out of my system. I found that they were not significantly better than production guitars. They're better. And of course, right now somebody's reacting to that. Like, what? My custom shop blows my production. Probably does. I'm just telling you my experiences. My experiences are, the custom shops have not been blowing away my production guitars. There's things I like about them, but a lot of those, again, are specs. They specified things that are, custom shop sometimes just ends up being, it's not that they made it better, they just put better things on it and in it that if they would have done in the production guitar, I would have probably been just as happy. I just don't, you know, maybe. Travis says, hey, can I fit the edge of my fingernail? Oh, I can fit the edge of my fingernail under the corner of my fret ends. Should I fill the gap with something or press down the fret to fix it? I would press down the fret to fix it. That's how I would address it. If you had a lifted fret, I would want to see if I could clamp it down and glue it. That would be my ideal situation because that would be easy, right? when fixing something. And then if that didn't work, then I would probably have to pull the fret and, maybe clean the slot, reslot it, and then refret the guitar, either that fret or all the frets, depending on how much wear the other frets have. And then that would be my way to fix it. I would not level it. I've said this when I've done the deep dives on the geeky stuff. I've done one where it had a lifted fret. So I tapped it back down and it worked and it was great. I was lucked out. And I had one where it was high and I leveled it. And somebody's like, why didn't you tap it down? And I'm like, Well, because it didn't have a gap. So when it has a gap, you want to definitely seat it back in correctly. If it doesn't have a gap and it's high, you definitely want to level it. That's usually the rules you would follow, and those have served me well, just sticking to that. Because I can tell you right now, if you do not seat it back into position correctly, if you don't press it down and you level it, it will become a problem later. It just will. Because it's if it's unseating, it's going to continue to do so. It's already coming out. It's going to just get worse. So, Beav says, or you can pull it and crimp the tang. You can do that as well. I like glue. Again, you know, hey, whatever gets the job done, right? Beavis, it's funny, it's Beavis, but whatever gets the job done, sure. But, you know, I like not, it's again, different mentalities, for whatever reason. My mentality is like, I'm thinking like when a customer brings me a problem like that, I don't want it to see it again. So like, I'm going to make it to where, you know, it never happens again because I don't want to see it in a couple months. It's a nightmare. So even though your way makes a lot of sense and actually it will probably work just as well and it's less invasive to the guitar, I just don't. My instinct is like I would rather make sure it's not going to do that way. So like I said, he's probably doing these repair himself. So Beavis, you're probably right. Your answer is probably even better than mine because his is less invasive and you're not shoving glue into things. But again, like I said, I kind of like think like a repair tech where it's like I just want the problem to be fixed and the customer to be happy and never come back with that problem again. So I kind of think in the, like, here's a permanent way to make that go away. Okay. Oh, he says if the glue doesn't do the job, you can do it too. Yeah, you can do both. You can hit it both. Yeah, like I said, it was a great suggestion, by the way, Beavis. Thank you. I actually liked it. That happens a lot on the show, by the way. You guys give comments, then I read them, and they're better than my answers, which is why I like having this show. I think that's one of the things people rely on. Sometimes they're like, hey, I have an answer, and then somebody has a different answer. Because again, you know, it's about the conversations we want to have. I like having the conversation and then seeing what comes from it. Ray says, do you buy clothes to match your guitars like I do? I don't, not unless all my guitars are black. Funny thing, can't answer the question about black shirts. Somebody asked my wife about me wearing black shirts all the time. That's going to be part two on this podcast. She's going to answer that question. And I don't want to steal her answer. But the answer to your question is I do not. I do not match my clothes to my guitars. What I can tell you that may help you guys is that if you watch the very first episodes of my channel, which I don't recommend, I was not wearing black shirts. I was wearing all kinds of colored shirts, blue, pink, red, all kinds of colors, gray. I used to wear a lot of gray and brown, but you know, obviously colors too. And now everybody knows me as always wearing a black shirt. The black shirts came from a necessity of making content. So you guys know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I like black shirts, but like if I go through photos of myself over the last, you know, 30 years, I'm not wearing black 90% of the time. I'm wearing black 20% of the time. The other 80% I'm wearing other colors. And but then on YouTube, if you watch me on YouTube, it's all black. And the main reason is marketing, so I could sell my shirts. No, because I'm not wearing one today. But it was because I would constantly find myself having to refilm things, and it was a lot easier to just wear the same clothes all the time, the same types of shirts. So like 2 days later, I'd be like, ah, crap. So it happens to me now. So you guys know. So if you're familiar with this, let me explain how my Patreon member program works for the most part. Obviously, they support the podcast. They're the sole sponsors. That's why we don't have any businesses on this podcast at all. If a business is being mentioned on the podcast or something's happened, it's something either we've discussed and we've okayed it, or it's for charity or something like that. The importance of that is that one of the things that the Patreon slash channel members do is they see the, you know how a lot of YouTubers like, and you get early versions, you get my video 2 days before everybody else. I don't do that. What they get is the first draft of my video. Sometimes they have to see a second and third draft, the first draft. And then they say things like, hey, Phil, you said 14-inch radius, it's 12. Hey, Phil, I don't understand what you're saying when you say sounds a lot like this. And I take those comments and suggestions, and then I sometimes re-edit, and sometimes I have to cut in new clips of me. And I've been doing that for years. One advantage I have is my haircut is the same every day. So that's fine. So as far as you know, everything's happening the way it was supposed to happen in the video. I've answered all the questions and I did it perfect and I'm great. But really what happened was a bunch of times I was spliced in fixing other things that were messed up. And so it was a lot easier for me if I went to my closet and I have like six of the same black shirts and I go, well, that's obviously what I wore 2 days ago, because sometimes it's a couple days later. So that's what started that. And then habit wise, it's just, I have so many now. And then every guitar company makes a black shirt and they send them to me. So it's like crazy. So there you go. So that's the main thing about it. It's not the sole reason, but that's the main reason why. Kev says crowdsource editing. You know what it is? We call it, we call it the focus group. It's, you're right. It's exactly that. It's amazing that I feel extremely lucky to be in a situation where the people who support my channel financially are also like the work. They're doing the work. They're the focus group. They tell me if something's good or something's bad, or and I don't mean, you know, obviously if it needs edits or if it's not interesting or if it needs to be shorter or longer. They actually have all that input on that, and that's what happens. So there you go. And they're right a lot. They are right a whole lot. I am really shocked. There are videos that I've made that were like 26 minutes, and they tell me it's a little long or there's something a little draggy in the middle, and I go edit it. And next thing I know, I release the final version. It's 21 minutes and the video just kills and it's hugely successful. And I think, wow, all of that over 3-4 minutes of editing, removing stuff. And so, you know, some of that stuff I would be scared if it was just me to remove, because I'd be like, you know, more is better, more. Yeah, so there you go. Okay. We got to stay focused. I got to stay focused. You guys, you can do whatever you want. You have fun. So it says, Rummy says, hey, Phil, why does the Fender Tele input jack always become loose? Every week I'm fixing a student's axe. Is there an upgrade? There is an upgrade to that jack. It's becoming loose because, you said students, so they probably don't have like the USA made Fender ones. The problem with that is, let me show you what he's talking about. If you don't mind, this will be Tele guitar output jack. Let me show you, hopefully. And like I always say, go to Stu Mac, right? They have everything. So here you go. This is what is happening in their guitar. Yeah. And like I always say, this is essentially the anatomy of that.
They have everything.
Output jack. So here you go. Here it is. This is what is happening.
And then you have this retainer clip.
And like I always say, this is essentially the anatomy of that. They have everything.
Output jack.
So here you go. And then the jack is what is happening.
And as the jack tightens.
And like I always say, cheaper guitars essentially are straight like this. They have like an
output jack.
So this thing stabs into
your jack. This is what is happening.
And as the jack tightens,
holds it.
And like I always say, cheaper guitars essentially
are straight like this.
They have like an output jack.
So
this thing stabs
into your jack. This is what
this
jiggles.
And as the jack tightens, biting into the sides of the wood. And I know all this is really tough in this kind of format when I'm explaining it, but you understand. It's not like your typical output jack. There's multiple parts that can fail, right? It's the worst case scenario. You have more than just the one crappy, is there two audios going? I apologize for that. So the problem is that there's multiple parts that can go wrong if you're looking at that jack. Okay, so the important thing to understand is that you want to replace that, not the whole mechanism, just replace the output jack, the actual jack itself. That's it. If a quality one, once you put a quality one in there, it'll do that. But you have to replace it. The other thing you can do is you can use some tight bond, put it on the threads a little bit. Maybe that helps a little bit. I've said it before. I use the purple tight bond. There's different kinds of tight bond that you can get. Purple tight bond is the one I use. It's basically for vibration. It's not huge. It's not really hard to deal with. So if you put a little bit on there, you can always break this seal very easily. So there you go. Okay. So let's go to, thank you, Litvay. Tarnished Viking says, I received my Floyd Rose FRX surface mount. Have you ever installed one of these or used one? I haven't. And if you did, what are your thoughts on them? I haven't tried it yet. You know, Floyd Rose makes so many different products now, and I haven't tried a ton of them. You know, it's not something I've installed. I've seen it. I've seen the device you're talking about. It looks interesting, but I haven't. Not only have I not installed it, I've never tried it. Jeff says, the 1 amp for home volume is not an issue. Okay. The amps Tone Master, Princeton, Deluxe Reverb, 265, Princeton, 65 Deluxe Reverb, Fender Blues Jr., Vox AC15. I mean, this is tough. All these are great. You know, you're asking for recommendations. You know, I kind of cheat, as you know. I like to go and just basically, he says the last time he'll ask. I will tell you this. I have a Princeton. I absolutely love it. I have a Deluxe Reverb, and I absolutely love it. I have the Tone Master Deluxe Reverb, and I absolutely love it. I don't have a Blues Jr. right now. Ralph has the Blues Jr. I would say, I don't know. I don't have an answer. Isn't that sad? I know these questions are the hardest ones. Isn't that funny? Like, things that are about tech specs or maybe experiences and stuff are easy, but like, what amp do I think you should get is a tough question for anybody to answer. What I can tell you is those three particular amps, the Princeton, the Deluxe Reverb, and the Tone Master amps, I love them all. And I love them all, and I totally, I don't know. and I use them all the time because I have them in different rooms. So I don't know. I'm trying to think of anything to throw at you. I think if I could only, that's what I'm trying to say is like, I'm trying to think if I can only have one, if I can only have one of those amps, which amp would I take? And I think the answer is, I would probably keep the Deluxe Reverb, the real one. If I can only have one, it's just because it's such a good amp. And they're all really good, but I think I would just go the one. And it's the most expensive. So unless you're trying to save some money or have something, a smaller footprint or something, I would go with just the Deluxe Reverb. I don't think you'll ever regret the Deluxe Reverb. That's where I think I'd go with that. I don't think you'll ever regret it. Okay. Music J says, hey Phil, looking to change pickups in my GNL Legacy HB, looking for thump in the lows and sparkle in the highs, Hendrix to Neo Soul. You don't like the GNL pickups? They're not doing it for you? That's one thing about GNL I like. I like their pickups. And obviously you got the GNL Legacy humbucker. I'm taking humbucker. I don't know. I really like the Bare Knuckle Mules. They're really nice. I like the Seth Lover pickups from Seymour Duncan and the 59s. Those are nice. I like 36th anniversary PFs from DiMarzio. They're really nice. I mean, you know what's funny is most pickups, if you just go with what the vintage style pickups, you're going to be really happy. I mean, those are really, you know, that's the anatomy everybody's been working off of for everybody for years. It's really good stuff. The Slick Nick says, yo, Phil, got a string through Carvin CT6 with a graphite saddle bridge, and I have a hum issue from it not being grounded. How can I fix it? So you basically have to go underneath and look to make sure that the ground wire is touching the bridge that's touching all the electronics in the cavity. It's grounded to the electronics in the cavity. So that's the first thing you have to do. Obviously, you didn't I'm assuming you didn't buy the Carvin new because Carvins, they're not making Carvins now. So somebody might have messed with it, especially after they changed out the graphite saddles and the GraphTech saddles, graphite saddles in the bridge. So that hum is definitely, my guess, is happening because there's no ground wire there. So that you have to find it. So it's there and you got to make sure it's touching the bridge. One thing you can do is you can take a wire, touch it to the bridge, and then run it in and ground it out to the electronics and see if that solves the problem. And then you know there's no wire underneath. But I would actually take the bridge off and just make sure that the wire's touching, full contact. So, Destructo. Ah, I get it. It's nice, like a phonetic thing. With a Z. Destructo says, hey, Phil, I got a Gibson scale guitar. I want to keep in C standard. Any tips for tuning stability? Bigger strings? That will help a lot, right? The scale length is not super short. You know, obviously, Zach Wild played a Gibson tuned in C standard, right? Totally be done. What's Zach Wild's strings? Let's just see that. Zach Wild had specific strings for that tuning. So that'll give us an idea what he used to get that huge 10 to 60. So he was using 10, 13, 17, 36, 52, and 60 from Dunlop. You don't have to buy his strings, but now you know you're going to need 10 to 60. So that, think about this. He wasn't even using a thicker gauge all the way through the entire set, 10, 13, and 17. So really what he did is he ramped up 36, 52, and 60. So he kept the low strings, kind of bigger so they keep more taut. Right. And so it has more of a thump and less of a like a flubby kind of like just laying on the fretboard kind of feel. So that's what I would recommend for that. Bigger strings. Thank you, Susan, for the super chat. And thank you, David, for a super chat. I appreciate that as well. Let's go ahead and let's not do any more super chats. Let's see what you guys are talking about. El Dunarino says he's using 11 to 56s for standard C on a PRS. Yeah, that would make sense to me, man. You're going to get that. You're going to get bigger strings. That's the best way to do it. Okay. Hold on. I'm just looking. If you're talking to me, put the question marks at the beginning. Jeff said, thanks. I appreciate it, Jeff. I feel like I didn't give you that great of an answer, but I appreciate the thank you. Okay. Hold on. Some of the stuff you guys come up with is crazy. Glop wants to know if there's any new interesting amps coming out soon. I'm aware that there's some new amps that are actually kind of cool. A well-known tube company is going to be coming out with some pretty cool solid state style amps. And, I like this, it's kind of like in a more affordable price category. I believe that's happening, in September. That's the most I can say about it. Right. They're being sent to me now because I don't have actually time. And the person running social media for them is a friend of mine. And so when he asked me, I was like, okay, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to do it when they need it done. So I'm going to try to get it done now. So they're going to get those to me a little early so I can just knock out the video and then send them on their way and get the video out. And then so you guys know, I'm not going to be part of their official product launch. I try not to do those if I can help it. But I'll release, shortly after their official product launch, and then I'll have some insights and some discussion. I'm obviously very interested in these amps. I'm interested in this idea. I am not stuck on tubes, as I've said before. I like amps that sound good, and just so happens that most of the amps that I think sound good are tube amps, but that doesn't mean tube amps sound good and solid-state amps sound bad. I think it's time, especially now, to keep trying to push and bring back as many solid-state type technologies as possible. I think there's a lot. I think there's a big market for it. I'm interested in it. I'm interested in great sounding solid state amps. So, I like the idea of the amps being a little lighter, sound a little better, and be a lot cheaper. you know, these two amps are getting crazy. It's getting expensive. Steo, I'm going to say the Steo, would you recommend any cheaper fret filing tech other than StuMac would cheap Chinese do? I did a video with Amazon tools, and if you want to watch that, that's just me going through them. That's a reaction type video where I go through them and stuff and kind of give you my insights on them. Like I said before, you know, the tools, nice tools are just a blessing, right? If you have nice tools, it's like nice gear. It's like nice things. Nice things, it's a, you know, yeah, it's great. If you have it, you know, if you have it, it's great. But skills, you know, skills are more important. So you can do it if you just if you practice and focus on it. My tools now are much nicer than where I started with. Just like my guitars now are much nicer than what I started with, you know. And to be honest with you, the irony is I agree with some people when they say, I know I'm jumping from tools to guitars, but I agree with some people when they say, well, a better guitar makes you play better. This is true. But once you get better, then you can make cheaper guitars sound better too. So, I mean, it can work both ways. Same thing with tools, right? Once you hone your skills a little bit, nicer tools make life easier and it's more pleasant. But you can still make cheap tools do what you need them to do. I can't even count the times I've fixed a guitar in a hotel room with essentially a Swiss Army pocket knife and, you know, whatever I can find. You just make it work. Okay. Hold on a second. I think I have some of the moderators sending me questions. Okay, hold on. All right, hold on. I got another cool question here. Joe says, "Hey, hey, Phil. Greetings from SoCal Hurricane Alley. What method do you prefer for putting on new strings on a standard tuner for tuning stability?" So I did a video where I go over like the three methods that that people see. Some people will call it like the locking method. I call it the scorpion tail, where essentially when you wrap the string, you start the wrap with one wrap over where the hole in the post is, and then one under, and then it kind of comes together and it pinches the string. That is what I call the factory method. I don't know of any guitar company that doesn't ship a guitar without that being the method being that they do it. A lot of people like it because they say it's a locking tuning key because it's pinching it down. Sure, it works. It works great. Sometimes you can do I call it the three finger method, where you essentially just measure out three finger and you do three wraps, measuring that out. I tend to, as a habit, so this is where, like I said, this is where it's tough for me because I'm not a guitar player. Like, I'm not a touring musician / musician. And so sometimes on those channels where those musicians talk, they're going to tell you what they do. This is what I do on the road. This is how I like things. All my years experience that can be helpful to you is in repair and mostly repairing people's stuff. And so therefore, a lot of times my insight is in what everyone's doing and why they're doing it. What I will tell you, two reasons I'm going to give you this. I restring guitars the way somebody gave it to me. So if a person gives me their guitar, and they use like the factory method, that's the method I use. If they use a different method, I use whatever method they're using. If they look like an utter crap show, the strings all wrapped, I go, hey, do you know how to wind strings? Do you want me to show you? And then maybe I won't follow that method, right? So, I mean, to some degree. Me personally, I like locking tuning keys. But I will generally use the factory method or the three wrap method, depending on the guitar. It just depends on what I'm doing. I know it's kind of like not really a hard answer, but so you know, if we're talking about me personally, I almost don't own any guitars that don't have locking keys, because if I can have locking keys, I mean, I'm going to take that every time. And it's just because, again, faster. It's much, 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 much faster. Okay. Let me see another one. Oh, hold on. There's so many screens now. Okay, Guitar Man says, Phil, I've been wanting to change my trim block in my road-worn 50s Strat made in Mexico to a steel one. Is there really that much difference? It's subtle. I mean, I did a block test. I've told you guys I've done them for years for customers, and then I thought, okay, let's do one. And I did one with a guitar that I really trust and love, and I changed all the blocks. And here's what I noticed. For me, I noticed the mass changed the feel of the bridge more than I noticed the sound. So having a bigger block or a heavier block, whether it was made from stone or if that was made from brass or steel, it changed the feel. I told you guys once I put a titanium block on one of my Strats because it was super expensive, but it lightened up the guitar and I thought I was interested in it, and I just didn't love the way it felt and sounded anymore. So again, it's back to the bone nut versus synthetic bone, a brass block versus, you know, a steel block. Are these big differences? I don't think they're big differences. They're subtle differences. You're chasing very subtle differences. And if you have the money and time and you want to do it, I think you should do it. It's fun. It's fun. Do it. I don't really subscribe to the whole, it's a waste and don't do it. Look, man, if you got the money and you got the time and you want to see how it works for you, I say try it. I think the recommendation I can give you is if I tell you not to, right? Like, don't. It's a waste. They're not super expensive. You know, a steel block and a brass block's not super expensive. And you won't know until you try it yourself anyways. But what I will tell you is don't expect a lot out of it. That's what I really like to, not instead of tell you to do something or not do something, I'd rather tell you, give you a realistic expectation of what you're about to experience. A subtle difference. You're gonna, right? There you go. Do with you will. I've done much more to a guitar to achieve much less just because I was curious. And, you know, it's not the worst thing to do with an afternoon. So, there you go. It's kind of funny, right? They, hold on. Okay. Wiggy. That's great. Do you always trust that the first fret is the right height when setting the nut slot depth? No. In fact, no. So I don't use that. I don't use the first fret as the determining factor for the nut slot slots. So you guys know, as you know, I made fret gauges that I use, and those are, I'll use those on the fast if I need to check something and do something quickly. But no, I don't go off what the first fret says. So there you go. It's everything is just a general look until you know, like I said, everything's like a diagnostic thing. You're just looking at situations and then going from there and figuring out how to figure out what you got to do next. Oh, Derek says Callahan blocks are great. I like Callahan anything. I think the quality of their stuff is awesome. So, Jay, I don't even know how to say this. JG Mopar, think like the parts, right? JG Mopar says the blocks don't do enough to justify the cost and time to change, in my opinion. Yeah, well, he's saying it perfectly. JG's saying it perfectly. It doesn't do enough. You'll have to decide that for yourself, or you may from these conversations. But I think what he's saying is what I'm saying too, which is it's a good amount of work if you want to try it, because you want to try it. But like I said, your expectations should be what he said and what I said, which is, you know, it's not going to be like, whoa, I was missing this the whole time. I'm not saying, you know, it's nothing. I'm just saying it's not, you know. And if you have other things you might want to improve on the guitar, maybe focus on those expenses first. So, all right. I think we're about to wrap it up, right? Let's see. I know I missed. Hold on. I just want to make sure. I thought I missed one super chat. And it was from Mr. S, who says, cover for, this is, I didn't miss it. I just didn't understand it. So I'll try to hit it now since we're at the end. Cover for less, Paul. That's removable, clear, or opaque. I don't know what that is. So that's my way of saying I don't really understand what cover for less, Paul. That's removable, or clear, or opaque. Is so I there you got an I don't know. Okay.
Hold on. This is the end. Okay, I think we did it. I think we did a show. It's pretty cool. I'm trying to think if there was anything on my announcements thing. I think I made all the announcements I had. If you guys don't mind, I'll share something with you that I was excited about. You know, some of you guys aren't going to be as excited. That's for sure. But I thought I would share with you. I was really blown away. So let me share it with you. Okay, I don't know how to share it. Hold on a second. Well, maybe I can't share it with you. Because it's not coming up. Then we'll share it for next... See, that's the anticipation for next week. Next week, I will share this with you. Something cool, something exciting. All right, on that note, I hope you guys have an amazing weekend. Thank you guys for, again, being great... great guests, because like I said, you're the guest of the show. The subjects and questions come from you. Thank you for all who submitted one through a super chat, through who just put in questions first, through got picked by moderators, who sent them to the knowyourgearpodcast.com website. You know, if I appreciate all of them, literally makes the show just super exciting. I wouldn't work without you guys, that's for sure. And as always, I want you guys to have a great weekend. Play some guitar. Have some cool videos coming. So hopefully you guys will enjoy those. If you guys haven't seen this week's video, I did a cool video of something totally different. I did the Fox 3 guitars. They make guitars that look like fighter planes with graphics on them. They were really cool guys. They donated $1,000 to Guitars for Vets. May not sound like a big deal. Maybe it sounds like a big deal. To me, it was a huge deal. I mean, as you guys know, much, much bigger companies I've asked to do something like that and they won't do it. So, you know, it's always really great whether you, however you feel about charity. I, of course, if anything, I'm all for charities that are for mental health or for, you know, making somebody's life better, whether it's, you know, helping cure cancer to helping cure mental issues, mental stability, mental health, physical health, physical stability, anything like that. It's just what I care about. So the fact that they did that was just awesome, and they were cool dudes. And so if you end up wanting to watch the video, I'll put a link to it, because, you know, it's not like they're not out there really trying to beg you to buy guitars or anything. They just really want to get their idea out there, and really you could be helpful, not even just buying a guitar, but giving them feedback on their guitars. They're a new company, and they got a lot of excitement and a lot of stuff going on. I really enjoyed it. So, and I enjoyed doing the video, that's for sure. So on that note, I just want to thank you guys so much for your time. Until next Friday, I guess I'll just end with Know Your Gear. All right. Goodbye.